Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 30, text number 15. Asteva matyopanyastam.
Asteva matyopanyastam.
Grihapala ivaharam.
Grihapala ivaharam.
Amaya yapraditagnya.
Amaya yapraditagnya.
Alpaharo chestita.
Alpaharo.
Asteva matyopanyastam.
Asteva matyopanyastam.
Grihapala ivaharam.
Grihapala ivaharam.
Amaya yapraditagnya.
Amaya yapraditagnya.
Alpaharo chestita. Negligent. Upanyastam. What is placed? Grihapala. A dog. Iva. Like. Aharam. Eating. Amayavi. Disease. Apadita. Agni. Having dyspepsia. Alpa, little. Ahara, eating. Alpa, little. Chestita, his activity. Translation. So this, before I read this translation, this section of the Bhagavatam is describing the life of the attached householder, and his life is very foolish and causes himself and others great misfortune. And at this part of the Bhagavatam, it is describing that after working very, very hard all his life for his family, even in sinful ways, this is now his position. Thus he remains at home just like a pet dog and eats whatever is so negligently given to him. Afflicted with many illnesses such as dyspepsia and loss of appetite, he eats only very small morsels of food, and he becomes an invalid who cannot work anymore. Report by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Before meeting death, one is sure to become a diseased invalid. And when he is neglected by his family members, his life becomes less than a dog's, because he is put into so many miserable conditions. Vedic literature is enjoined, therefore, that before the arrival of such miserable conditions, one should leave home and die without the knowledge of his family members. If a man leaves home and dies without his family's knowing, that is considered to be a glorious death. But an attached family man wants his family members to carry him in a great procession, even after his death, and although he will not be able to see how the procession goes, he still desires that his body be taken gorgeously in procession. Thus he is happy without even knowing where he has to go when he leaves his body for the next life. So one time Srila Prabhupada was, when he was, in the last months of his life, his disciples were carrying him upstairs, I think. I'm not sure exactly which temple it was. They had to carry him in a palanquin upstairs. He had to answer the call of nature and various things. Prabhupada was laughing, wondering why he was laughing. Anyway, there was some ancient Bengali saying that, basically, he was laughing because there was such a grand procession, basically to carry him upstairs, so he could just really answer the call of nature, so he thought that was quite humorous, everyone going to so much trouble, but really, he was considering he wasn't really able to do very much after all the trouble of going to carry him upstairs. So he thought it was quite a humorous situation. But, and here, it's similar. You see here that, not comparing Prabhupada's life to the attached materials, but basically, someone dies after wasting their entire lifetime, and although their life is very inglorious, they want to be carried in a great procession, in a grand coffin, just like in the I think the 80s and the 90s, one of the most significant underworld figures in the history in Melbourne, a drug lord who was responsible to keep up his drug empire. He had several, maybe a dozen or so people killed. So he's basically a murderer and a drug pusher, and engaged in so much sinful activities. But when they buried him, he was buried in a solid gold coffin. And they were thinking, he would like that, and that was fitting. So he's just a very lived a disgusting, sinful, horrible life, always untold miserable to so many people, but he was buried in a gold coffin, carried in a big procession. And other people who were living also very sinful and disgusting lives, took great pride in carrying that coffin. So, it's just a ridiculous situation. Here, it's just, this is the natural course of life. That all of us have to just understand that. No offense to us, Dave, some of the older members, but as you get older, you can't work as hard. Your voice doesn't sound as good. And sometimes you can do less and less, for those who you're related to. And so you tend to get neglected. People don't really take much interest in you. Now, that's the normal materialistic way of life. Gradually, even if a person is a great king or great personality in so many different ways, basically when they become old, people just, you know, don't really care about them. They're not attractive to look at. You know, if you have a discussion with them, you know, they, elderly people talk a lot slower than, you know, younger people. By the time an elderly person finishes half a sentence, the younger person's already bored. And, so that's just, you know, the natural way of life. And it doesn't matter whether, you know, that the elderly persons have contributed massive amounts of work or, you know, austerities, you know, for, you know, others. It's all forgotten very quickly. Everything is forgotten. You know, that's the nature of this world. Yesterday, you know, we have Anzac Day. Yesterday was Anzac Day. And, you know, they try to remember that for a lot of people, it's something that happened in the past, you know, the wars and what have you. But actually, many of those soldiers, literally very heroic, and they gave up their life so that, you know, we could sit here today in freedom. But for a lot of people, it's forgotten. That, you know, they're just not interested. A lot of people who may have been connected to those relatives may still, you know, take part and what have you. But for the generations, generally, they forget that. Recently, I was in... now, the interesting thing here is that recently I was in Mwulumbah, and I noticed that, you know, on the Mwulumbah farm, they have, you know, quite an array of very senior devotees, you know, from, you know, sannyasis, people who may have been GVCs, temple presidents, book distributors, preachers, very, very, you know, and, you know, Sankirtan devotees from the 80s and what have you. And what I notice, especially, you know, when it comes time for prasadam and different things, is that there's very, you know, apart from some sections, but there's a distinct lack of proper reciprocation with those elder devotees. So even in ISKCON, you know, we face a similar, you know, situation. And I was talking with one devotee. So he joined just a little after me, but, you know, he was a Sankirtan devotee. And we were having a bit of a laugh because, you know, he was telling us about the sleeping arrangements. You know, basically, you know, you sort of find a spot where you really wouldn't imagine a dog might lie down. You know, there's no bedding, there's no, and you know, at the end of the day, there's a space there. That's the main thing. There's a space. That's, you know, it's considered a good spot for a bed because there's actually somewhere enough to lie down. That's it. There's no other facility. So somehow you've got to squeeze together something to, you know, lay down and be comfortable over the night. And so, you know, we were having a bit of a chat about that and laughing, you know, at some of the current conditions. You know, I remember the day I joined here in 1978, I said to Ramai Swami on the first night, he was a brahmachari, because I was a hippie, you know, I didn't really follow any austerities at all, nothing. And you know, my mind and senses were completely out of control. But strangely enough, amongst my circle of friends, I was considered very austere and self-controlled. But I said to him, you know, do devotees have, do they have cold showers? And, you know, he could probably sense a little apprehension, you know. And he said, oh, something, yeah, not really, not really. And So anyway, I left with him on the bus the next day, and then we travelled across to West Australia. And pretty much the next night, I was, you know, when the bus stops, you're just out, you know, getting up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning from Mongolia. And you have to stand out in the middle of, you know, out in the open, in your cope, and throw a bucket of cold water at you and have a bucket bath. And it was so austere, you know, coming from hot showers to doing that. Some of the bus crew, when the bus stopped, so we stopped, you know, near some bushes or something, you know, away from people so that we could actually, you know, there was no other people or houses around, but they would go way out in the bush so that, you know, when it came Mongolia, you couldn't find these devotees because they just weren't coming in for that bucket bath. They were going to come in later for breakfast. And Ramai would sometimes say, you know, no Mongolia, no breakfast, but he never followed through. So he always gave him breakfast. But, you know, it was very, very difficult. And, you know, on Sankirtan, in the early days, we never ever got a cabin, or to speak of a motel. You know, it was usually a tent. Quite often we just park the car somewhere. Usually if there's three or four people in the car, that means perhaps one or two can sleep in the car, and the others just go to sleep in the road at that. And, you know, we would camp by a river, and, you know, or the ocean. Or sometimes we'd sneak into the hospital and have a shower. But, and, you know, Sankirtan Prasad was very, very simple. There wasn't always facility to cook. Sometimes lunch was a bag of potato chips and a block of butter. You know, different things. But, and anyway, this devotee was having a laugh, you know, that now you still get complaints, even though, you know, most devotees in the ashram have their own rooms, or, you know, one or two rooms, they have an actual bed, and you've got a door that you can shut. You know, because sometimes in those days, even if you've got something that you sort of made a bit of a cubicle, you know, somehow, there's no question of a door. But, you know, now they have doors and everything, and rooms and beds and, you know, hot showers and so many different things. But, you know, I was just, I did give a class here, and I did mention that, because the class was saying how that generally when in this world we tend to be interested in our own particular situation, our own happiness at that time, and that can happen even, you know, with devotees. You know, this is my time to, you know, get attention, to, you know, shine as a devotee and so many things like that. And the nature of this world, as soon as we think about ourselves, someone else will suffer. You know, that's just the very nature of this world. It's, you know, as soon as there's personal motivation, you can guarantee someone else will miss out, someone else will go without, so that we can enjoy. That's the nature of the material world. It's a place of scarcity. It's a struggle for survival. It's a place of scarcity. The spiritual world is different. Everything is unlimited. But here, there's a limited amount. And so as soon as people are not looking after the interest of others, but looking after their personal interest, someone must suffer somewhere. And so what happens is that, you know, this verse in the Bhagavatam was described, it was in the 11th canto, that when we think of our own, you know, personal enjoyment, situation, success, happiness, there can be, if someone impinges on that, we can have some envy or you know, some dissatisfaction with that person. So, for instance, again, let's get back to the elderly persons. Say, let's take the doorway out here. This doorway out here is one of my favourite spots for seeing, you know, the Bhagavad Gita in action. Say a young person's running to go upstairs to get prasadam, and they don't want to miss out the maha. And as they're coming through the doorway, one of the elderly persons coming through, you know, and they're thinking, oh, this person, I'm going to miss the maha. I'm coming through first, like that. So they sort of barge in front of the, you know, the elderly person. The elderly person's like, you know. So as soon as there's that sense of... so even in devotional communion, so we look at these verses and we think, oh, they're the materialists like that, but we always have to remember that we're coming off the same streets, we came in coming from the same background, these tendencies are there. So what happens is that if that young devotee is running upstairs and an elderly person wants to get through the same door at the same time, there may be the sensation that this elderly person is in my way. Right? You know, this perp, so you've caused me trouble. So that, you know, when that sort of it is a form of envy. It expands into envy. You know, that you know is allowed to grow. But we don't want anyone else's existence to impinge upon my particular level of, you know, enjoyment in this world as a devotee or non-devotee. And if it does, we become envious. Why is that person doing that? You know, why is that elderly person walking so slowly through that door right at the time Maha is being served out upstairs? So, now, in the Bhagavad Gita, it describes that envy, when a person becomes envious, in fact, they're being envious of their own self. You know, so it's an unusual concept. And I gave the example in order to help to understand this, that sometimes I've seen birds and, you know, if you're in the car, or sometimes you're in traffic, you see a bird lands on someone's external mirror, and they start pecking at the bird in the mirror. Has anyone ever seen that? Yeah. So the bird lands there on the mirror. You know, they might have stopped at the lights or something. They start pecking at the bird in the mirror like that. So they're pecking at their own self, and that's the Bhagavad Gita describes. That is the nature of envy. That when we have that sense that someone else's happiness is impinging upon mine, and there's a, you know, a very subtle or a strong sense of envy, in fact, we are being envious of our own self, because in the long run, it comes back on us. We're literally causing ourselves trouble. So I explained to that community up there in the class that what happens, you know, I distinctly noticed that they're so fortunate to have so many elderly devotees, but in many occasions I saw personally, you know, that there was no recognition, you know, that, so for instance, sometimes a devotee might come up for a scoop of khichdi. And they may give him one, and then they may say, oh, can I have a little more? And then, you know, no, you can't have more. And, you know, I'd be looking at that devotee, and I was thinking, I know that devotee. That devotee's contributed, you know, probably $1 million so to feed millions of people. And here he is in line trying to get a little khichdi, you know, after a glorious life in Krishna consciousness. And there's just no sense of, you know, what that person has ever done, which is shameful, you know, to me. So, you know, I was mentioning that, just like the example with the bird, that when whether they be materialists or spiritualists. When we neglect our elders, what will happen to us when we get old? Is that we will also be neglected. And that's the bird pecking itself like that. So, you know, for the younger generation of devotees, for them to neglect their elders, you can guarantee that, you know, after a long, glorious life, even in Krishna consciousness, then when you get to the point you cannot work so hard or, you know, doing so many things, you're definitely neglected. That is the bird pecking at itself like that. You know. So, and confirm. Sense gratification, you know, it is the nature of, you know, here in this Bhagavatam is describing, as we go further, it describes these hellish conditions that people suffer. And when you first read it, you think, wow, that's a, you know, these scriptures, they give these terrible descriptions of hell, you know. Someone does some transgression and, you know, God is such a, you know, fearful, you know, person that loves to punish people, that they get punished severely for these things which aren't, you know, very important at all. You know, as we come through the Bhagavatam, we see that a person who enjoys sex life in this world, that, you know, there's these hells that they go through. And, you know, for most people in this world, they may be thinking, you know, how can that be? You know, the harmless sex life, and they've got these descriptions of these horrible, hellish places. But generally, whenever there's a question of looking after one's own interest, immediately we fail to see the interest of others. That is the nature of it. As soon as we look after our own personal interest, our ability to see the interest of other living entities immediately stops there. It's like a big wall goes up. And just like, you know, smoking cigarettes, you know, people have always, you know, they want to smoke cigarettes and so many things. So they create laws that now you have laws that you cannot smoke in a public place. Now, for people who want to smoke cigarettes, they think that's outrageous. How dare you? You know, you discriminate against me. I can't do this. You know, I'm not free to smoke where I want. They're getting all the benefits that they're allowed to sit there and not smoke. Where's the laws protecting me so I can smoke there? Okay. Those laws are made because the person who smokes, because their interest is to smoke, they're not looking at the interest of the others. More people die by passive smoking than the people who smoke. You know, passive smoking means that, you know, people go to somewhere to sing a song about love, rainbows and happiness, and they end up dying of cancer of the throat because everyone in the audience is smoking cigarettes. Little children, you know, grow up in a house full of smoke and get in the cars with the parents, and you know, they die of cancer. They've never touched a cigarette. It's passive smoking. But the person, you know, who is interested in that particular form of sense gratification, they cannot see beyond. And if someone impedes upon their, you know, what they're doing, they become very disturbed. And sex life is also like that. It's like now in Yemen. You know, I started this class at, I can't see the clock in my eyes here. 7:30. Yeah. What time is it now, about? Was that?
Quarter past eight.
So that's about 40 minutes ago.
Yeah,
45. So in Yemen, 4 children died since the time I began class. Every 10 minutes, one died. 4 children. And dying of starvation. You know, preventable. So, you know, if you look at the situation, the people, you know, even in Yemen itself, there were people there right now, and they'll be seeing children dying all around them, and they were still bringing another child into the world. So that's, you know, adding to the problem. And then from the other sides of the world, you know, people just go on with, you know, creating a wonderful atmosphere for sex life. You know, so just all the pros and cons, all the, you know, bells and whistles, as they say, so that in the Western world they can have a very elevated opportunities for enjoying sex life in so many different wonderful ways. And they do that spending money, billions of dollars, lavishly, while others just starve to death. That's sort of like passive smoking, isn't it? You know, there's a, the results of sex life is that passive, you know, problems. It seems very harmless. So, you know, that's the nature of this world. Therefore, you know, there are laws, government laws, just like people take intoxication. They get so high, they can barely walk. They would struggle to blow their nose. You know, they struggle to speak. Yet they'll jump in a car, turn it on, and plant their foot to the, you know, metal to the pedal, pedal to the metal, and end up plowing through some family who's just coming back from a picnic on the beach and just, you know, cleaning them up. But if they get caught, you know, say they get caught before they do something, then they become angry at the police, angry at the society, like that, and they get caught again, and they get caught again, they get caught again. So they have laws, because the person's doing that when they're considering their own sense of enjoyment. They are just blind to the, you know, the tragedy that they can cause. So, you know, for us, being sober, you know, we couldn't imagine being in such an intoxicated state and just so blind to other people's suffering that you're just going to plow through. You know, if you run into someone, you know, if you get out and just run into that tree in the courtyard, it's going to really hurt. You know, a car hitting you is like a cannonball, like a huge, you know, very, very powerful. So, you know, that's the nature of sense gratification in this world on every level. So therefore, there are laws that say you cannot see the evil of your way, that what you are doing for your pleasure. But we have a law because sane people, intelligent people, know the consequences, and therefore we put a law to it. And the laws of karma are like that. So as we go through the Bhagavatam and you hear these very fearful descriptions of the hellish planets, and some of the sinful activities are activities which generally people take as just, you know, their right to, you know, have sex any old time, and drugs any old time, and meat any old time, and abortion any old time, like that. So, you know, there are karmic laws as well, because when the sense gratification is there, there is no ability to perceive beyond that the consequences to other persons. So that's this section of the Bhagavatam. So also here, within this Bhagavatam, some of the descriptions really shock you out of a sense of, you know, what's the word, where a person is just not thinking very clearly, not very sharp. There's a term for shocked out of a sense of slumber. Slumber will do. What's that? Dull? Did you say dull? Dull, yeah, dullness, yeah. So as Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes, you know, generally we're sleeping in the lap of the witch called Maya. That's the way he terms it. The nature of this world is like that. You get lulled in a sense of false security. And years go by, decades go by, your whole life goes by, next thing, death, like that. And then, thrown into another body. It's a really scary thought. I mean, a lot of us ended up, in a reasonable place in this life, if we're somehow doing okay, come to the temple, but, you know, you think about it, if you take birth again, where in this world do you think you might take birth that you think you have some reasonable sense of, you know, living conditions, especially as Kali Yuga gets worse and worse and worse. You know, it's a scary thought, you know, being picked up, thrown somewhere else on this planet. Like that. You know, even nice devotees, you know, take birth in some, you know, very difficult places. You know. What to speak of, you know, the materialists who are engaging very, activities that cause so much harm to other living entities. You take birth, you know, in the body of a dog, you know, a frog, an elephant. You know, elephants, they just kill them, cut their tusks out of their head. In fact, they're not even quite dead. So, you know, here, this section of the Bhagavatam is like that. Wake up. You know, wake up, sleeping soul. There's something very, very serious, very precarious about your existence, you know, floating around on this planet out in the middle of the, you know, in the universe. And it just appears, you know, the nature of the material world is, you know, the illusion is quite substantial. So just like here, we're sitting here, it just appears like we're just on real solid ground. But actually we're, you know, pivoting, you know, around. There's so much movement in the universe, you know, quite, you know, massive speeds. Just like whenever I'm in an aeroplane or a car, you always know that, you know, there's a real element of danger because you're just going so fast, you're hurtling. So we feel like we're in just this stable, safe place, but actually, you know, in this universe, it's a very unstable place to be. And, you know, this planet, so many upheavals, so many difficulties. You know, I remember I was in New Zealand, and I said to a friend of mine who was a devotee, I said, you should get a water tank. He said, why? I've got water coming out of the tap. And I said, well, you won't always be that, you know, even in a place like New Zealand. And within about a year of me saying that, they had, you know, in Auckland, very, very severe water restrictions. So we're used to the fact, especially in Western countries like here, we're used to the fact you want light, you touch the light, goes on, you want water, turn on tap, and, you know, it goes like that. But in the future, even places like Melbourne, it won't be like that. You know, to those bare necessities, you know, as Kali Yuga goes on, can be quite a struggle. So the nature of this world is like that, that although it's a very, very precarious position, the Bhagavatam, it appears to be saying something very overly dramatic. But the Bhagavatam really is, even in what it's saying, is actually being quite gentle in trying to, you know, wake us up to the situation. Apart from the dangers of you know, living in this body, in this material world, you take another birth. You don't know. Once you get into your next body, will you again take up devotional service? Will you accept it? Will you fall away for 4 or 5 lifetimes? Could it be 10 or 100 births? Could it be 1,000 before we get a nice opportunity like this again? What to speak of the dangers if we miss the opportunity of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement? That Lord Chaitanya has given us that opportunity that if you can just chant Hare Krishna, you don't have to go through the usual process. If you look at, you know, in many places in the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada, Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, it's described that actually to get out of this material world is very, very difficult. And there's, you know, a few rare souls that actually make it out of the material world with great austerity. And for us, of course, the opportunity is there. If we can just chant Hare Krishna nicely, which nicely means that we, you know, being careful of offences, which can create massive obstacles in our devotional service and bring it to a screeching halt. So if we can just chant Hare Krishna nicely, take a little prasad, do a little service, think of Krishna, we avoid the very, very difficult process that is usually there to go back to the spiritual world. So both the opportunity being missed and the dangers of being in this world, it's sort of all forgotten. And that's the nature of the material energy. That even though there are extremely important considerations to be had, the nature of material energy, if there's a little bit of an opportunity to enjoy for a moment, every other consideration is forgotten within a second. That's the nature of material energy. Very, very powerful, constantly there. That is described in the Bhagavad Gita that when one contemplates. So there's just a little moment in the consciousness where we see something and think, gee, I could enjoy that. That looks nice and enjoyable. You know, there's the beginning of forgetting, oh, you're in the material world, you're in the material body. I can enjoy that. It's something like if you're in a blazing bushfire, so you went for a walk in the bush and all of a sudden fire rages up. Coming from the north and the south, with flames and reaching the top of the trees, and as you're trying to find your way out, you see a dollar. Well, someone's dropped a dollar, and you sort of stop. Oh, I can pick that up. Maybe I can get myself nice sweets or something. It's that moment of foolishness or madness. To forget such a terrible situation and just to be distracted for a second, life over, burnt, skin peeling off your body, your eyes popping out as the heat, blows your body. To stop for a dollar, it's ridiculous. You think no one is that stupid. But we do that, we make those decisions every day. We're in the material world, death is coming. Which body will we take? So many different things. And within that we just, there is something to enjoy about that. So, that is the power of Maya, material energy. She lulls us into a sense of forgetfulness. We sleep happily and we take Maya and cuts her head off. So therefore the Bhagavatam is, it's doing us a great favour in sometimes the intensity of the instruction, the reality of the instruction, just really hit home. Just things are stated very clearly, black and white. The Bhagavatam's not pulling its punches. It's like a parent with a child. When a parent know, sees it, it's their own child about to do something by which they will suffer immensely, you know, they just say straight out, you know, there's some things that a father or mother will say straight out to a child. You know, there's no embellishments of poetry. You know, you do that this way, like that. But they just want them to understand. I remember one time, my brother and I, we used to do a lot of crazy things. This, pretty much, you know, from the age of 8 or 9, you know, we were able to run around on the streets, you know, till about 10 o'clock, come home, jump to bed, and then get out of bed, you know, about 1 o'clock, and then run around the streets all night and come back again. So we used to just run around all over the suburbs, getting all sorts of mischief. When I was about 9 or 10, we used to sell ice creams at the picture theatres in Melbourne. So we used to travel from Broadmeadows and the Broadmeadows line where all the gangs were, and we'd go to the picture theatres in Melbourne. We'd sell, you know, you don't have them there, but you have a tray and you sell the little Dixie ice creams and the lollipops and so many different things. And then just that you catch the last train home, you know, and you're 10, 11 o'clock, you know, 11:30, and you get home somewhere around about midnight. And on the trains, no one was on the trains. They used to have the old red trains, and you know, one of the things we used to like to do was, when you stop at a station, if a gang got onto the train and they got on the same carriage as you were, you could actually open the doors and you'd hang onto the rails on the outside, and and there was a rail just under the train, and you'd get into the next carriage. He said, like that, while I was going. And then the other thing we'd do is you could take the light plugs out when you go through the tunnels. You'd smash in the tunnels, it sounds like hand grenades going up. But anyway, one time I was, you know, I had my legs, I was on the outside of the train, I had my legs on the bar, and I was hanging on. My brother was still in the train, and he looked at me and he just said, "Danny, get up, like that." And I just saw the look in his eye, and I understood I just had to do it. It was just the way he said it. Don't smile, don't say, "Oh, what for?" You know, you tricked me, and you just had to do it. It was just the way he said it. I immediately jumped in. And what it was, as you go along the rail tracks, they had the girders, you know, the girders, so they're like a H shape, and they're metal, and they run along the side of the track sometimes. So had I stayed on that rail, the girder would have just chopped my legs off at the, you know, basically at the ankle, you just chopped them off. That. So, but it was just, you know, the way he said it within that half, you know, get up. There's no time. So I just, there's a look in his eyes. And this section of Bhagavatam is like that. Wake up. Don't hesitate. Don't stop and think too much. Chant Hare Krishna. There's some really serious things happening. Like that. So it may seem very, very dramatic, but the nature of the material world is that we just completely forget our situation 100%, and there's a little opportunity to just enjoy something, some sense gratification, some adoration, this or that or the other, all the different trappings of Maya. And as soon as we do that, everything, all the dangers of the world is forgotten. That's the nature of the material energy. So we're very thankful to the Bhagavatam. Don't ever think that the Bhagavatam is being overly dramatic or too strong at that. So this is the nature of some of the verses that we're reading here in this third canto. So I'll just ask if there's any questions or comments.
Do the appearance view of Gadadhar Pandit or something? Appearance view of Gadadhar Pandit. Appearance day,
yep.
Of Gadadhar Pandit.
Gadadhar Pandit. Yeah. Gadadhar Pandit is Gadadhar Das and Gadadhar Pandit. So Gadadhar Pandit Panchatapa? Yeah. Very good, you know. So again, this is one of our great fortunes that, you know, 500 years ago, Krishna and his associates, Shaktis and residents of the spiritual world came to this world and just said, you know, despite the fact that no one has any qualifications in this lifetime, if you want love of God, Krishna Prema, just take it. Just take it. Okay. That is the nature of Panchatapa. Krishna appears once in the day of Brahma, which is so many billions of years, and after his day, after night and his day, Krishna appears once. So that was only 5,000 years ago. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates, they only ever appear after Krishna, but not every time Krishna comes. So every couple of days. And they've only appeared 500 years ago. So the that opportunity, which is the, if you take the personality of Godhead, who's unlimited, and he gives you, with all his potencies, everything at the fingertips of the personality of Godhead, and he gives you the greatest gift that he has available. He did that only 500 years ago. You know, Srila Prabhupada is the 32nd in Acharya in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Prabhupada himself, amongst Acharyas, did what no other Acharya ever did, because he is so dear to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He sent his best man, someone, you know, one of the disciples of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He was glorifying Srila Prabhupada to his disciples. And although he was a disciple of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he said, there is no Acharya greater than Srila Prabhupada. No one has ever done what he did like that. So that's within, you know, Prabhupada left this planet in 1978. His presence is, very...
77.
What's that?
1977.
77, yeah. So, you know, our good fortune is literally right there. So rare in the history of the universe. The greatest opportunity. We certainly don't want to forget that. And having, you know, we certainly don't want to forget the dangers of being in the material world. And we certainly don't want to forget that greatest opportunity. And all of that is available by the easiest process. There is no easier process ever been given. If you take the whole history of universal creation, you just chant Hare Krishna, you get the benefit. Prabhupada said, chant 64 rounds. And they said, oh, we cannot chant 64. Or chant 32 rounds. Or 16, I said. And by Prabhupada's mercy, if we chant those 16 rounds, we get the same benefit as chanting the 64 rounds. Again. So, you know, these are things which should never be forgotten from moment to moment. And the Bhagavatam is helping us to wake up and to be very alert and not miss one second of this life, not waste it. Waste that opportunity, you can end up just living like a dog as an old person, you know, with your family dying an inglorious death. That's the other alternative. And after that, there may be some punishments in the next life. That's the other alternative. Thank you. Hare Krishna.